When I popped in yesterday, I thought you were very in some kind of symbiosis on your two separate blankets, but I felt a parallel energy between the two of you.
Yeah, that's really nice because I think it was in 2018 that Elina and I were both invited for the same project. Partly by Zone to Source, based in the Amstel Park, about the Amstel Park, but it was also a reflection with Via Appia, and Elina was invited to do a project in both parks. My focus was on the Amstel Park, but somehow during the process we already started crossing over more or less.
How long ago was that?
I think in 2019, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, the project started. First time we met was November 2018.
Yeah.
I think this was the Socratic dialogue.
Yeah.
Where we kind of were introduced to each other and we spent the whole afternoon.
In the bigger group of artists.
Philosophizing. Mm-hmm. Is that English?
Yeah.
discussing. It was actually really nice. And then it must have been spring 2019 when we presented to each other our first ideas how to deal with these landscapes, our starting points. And already then we discovered that we are both, well, we already had a drill or we were interested in...
No, I did my drilling in September 2019.
Okay.
I think in the beginning of... Because when I was invited to do a project in the park, I was... I couldn't imagine myself relating to a park because I have for more or less 2 decades been working on the sea, coastal areas, dune areas, polders, wooden areas, whatever, in the Netherlands and abroad. So I was kind of wondering what I could do with the park, the concept of a park that is actually... designed 50 years ago as a horticultural show, but then somebody drew my attention to the Land in Wording.
How did you learn about this, Alice
or Ronald or one of the people that were already working in the park for a longer time, somebody mentioned it. And then in February, it was the first time that I went over to Land in Wording, because on the website, they say, this little patch of nature has the conditions of the landscape from before the Floriade.
But it was still a park then? It had still been established as a...
No, it was...
Formal parkland, no?
50 years ago, it became a park.
Oh, for the Floriade.
Yeah. And so I was, but
say, what was here before that? Was it a farmland?
Peat and peat extraction fields. Yeah. They're also here.
Yeah. If only we'd gotten here a bit earlier, we could have been doing a different type of work.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Now, so the story that it was a kind of untouched by human piece of land in a kind of... original conditions made me wonder, in the middle of Amsterdam, how can that be?
Mm.
Either they know a very good secret or, you know, there's something really special going on.
But recently you learned from the infamous Amstel Park ecologist that there is a peatland. Nearby.
Yeah.
And so is that the real Land in Wording?
I don't know, because we couldn't discover it yet. I have not found it yet.
No, we're on the hunt.
Yeah, yeah. As soon as we find it, we will do a radio recording on that particular original.
Maybe that's where we can invite Laurie Anderson.
Yeah, that would be lovely. Yeah.
We've got the location. Convenient for everyone. Yeah. Just in the middle.
Yeah, so the first time I went to visit in February 2019, at the beginning of the project that Eline mentioned, it was a mown piece of land.
Ah, mowing.
Yeah, it had these stubbles of reed like 10 centimeters high.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I have a theory that the Netherlands would go into economic turmoil if there was no mowing.
Yeah.
That it's really the mowing that holds the country up.
Yeah.
The mowing industry.
Yeah, that might be true. Yeah. It's part of the park nature policy.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I researched the history. I went to the archives and books and stuff and things, and then I reconstructed the history of that particular piece of land. And then in September we did the drilling.
There is just the cutest family of ducks swimming right past us.
There's a yellow one.
Oh, so cute! There's four ducklings and a mama or a papa.
The mother duck is this.
Mama duck.
Mm.
Wow.
Hi.
Hi. Guys. Oh, they look really strong.
But a nice cross connection as follow up of the question,
yeah.
Like you taking the course out of, I took them out of the ground and you took them from Rome, is that, and that also triggered this working period, is questioning whether through art or heritage or science, Tanya,
mm-hmm.
We can actually... do we give value to soil? Because we elevate it. We put it, I literally put it on a pedestal.
Mm.
We put it in different contexts so that people actually are, maybe become aware, because for us, soil is also, we study soil. We try to connect to soil, we try to understand it, whether it's through time or through the texture, or I mean, you can imagine a lot of approaches.
Mm. I have a question.
Yeah.
And obviously, like we speak to a particular audience, but what do you both feel like is the general reception when you're talking about soil or trying to engage people in conversations about soil? Is it more that people feel appreciative to that you share this like insight or your experiences, or do people feel a bit like that they don't really get it?
I think this morning I saw outside the Glazen Huis where we work, I saw a very tiny toddler with his father. And there are these mounds of soil that moles bring up to the surface on the grass. And the toddler just went boom, smack in the middle of that heap of soil, and was digging around with his... He was really enjoying
it.
Until the father turned around and saw the kids doing that, and he said, "No, that's dirt." And I think that's the most common perception of soil.
Yeah.
It's like dirt. Except when you're maybe also a farmer, of course, then you appreciate also kind of benefit from the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And as an artist or scientist, you have quite maybe another approach.
Yeah, but people see it sometimes as an inconvenience.
Yeah.
Not so much as something to be valued or to interact with, that... But
yeah,
it didn't interact with the soil.
Yeah, and also appreciate that it has, that it maybe has very genuine qualities of its own that we still have to discover. Yeah. Because it's so vulnerable. I mean, we stand on top of it, but the soil is also has such a vulnerable structure.
Mm. Yeah.
It's very delicate in that sense.
Yeah, like we can just dig it up with our hands. We can't really put our hand into a tree trunk.
No. No. Yeah. Oh, you can put a drill in it, but
we can put a chainsaw through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but let's not talk about that.
I have a question for you.
There we go.
So I met Jacqueline in 2018, and by that time you were already in conversation with each other or starting to work together, and you've been your work has been increasingly intensified in your collaboration. And I was wondering, from your perspective, what is it that interests you in working in the field of art or working with artists?
That's nice.
Yeah, I feel that often science has a really limited audience, and it's often, often research is just only extending to other researchers, and it's only being published in these academic articles, and sort of also, even if you do look, okay, even if a lot of researchers do look at who's going to be interested in these articles beyond other researchers, then the next people are policymakers, and it becomes this very top-down relationship.
Yep.
And I think the notion of doing science and doing that work is sort of from the bottom up. It's to care for the people and the planet and all of these sort of little guys. But then this point gets missed if we're always doing this top reach, like calling upwards.
Yeah.
And I guess I feel, that there's a strong value in sort of bringing science to anyone and everyone, and not only to like bring the science in a one-directional way, in that that scientists tell people how it is, but they also hear back feedback from all of these different anyone's and everyone's. That's, I guess, in a very gross way. Like in a really broad scale sense, that's how I feel. And like in terms of the interaction with Jacqueline, I guess it's also really valuable for me to question. Here I am asking you about how you feel about your drillings, but I don't know. Like we should also talk about how I feel about my drillings.
Yeah,
and. And what's happened there, and is that also really worth it? And I took a lot of drillings, maybe I took 30 cores from beneath the North Sea. So I disturbed 30 different sites and however many different homes of different microorganisms or different species living in the seafloor. And that's definitely something to think about. And also the fact that then these ecosystems have sort of been contaminated. Once I take the core out, then the ocean water fills in that space now, and maybe that's something we haven't done enough of, maybe I haven't done enough of, is looking at my own work through this same lens.
Mm-hmm. Because what happens with the cores after you drill them, you analyze them, you take samples, but then what happens?
Yeah, exactly. So then at one point it's kind of like you've finished or so, and then you've just I've just got sort of a library.
But are they in an archive?
Yeah, sort of an archive. I've just got a big refrigerator, of course.
But is this archive accessible to scientists only, or can anyone make an appointment to have a look at those cores? Because it is super interesting kind of knowledge for anyone, artists or non-artists, or anyone who is interested in this topic.
Yeah, we had one in the exhibition.
Yeah, well, in practice, I think it's not very accessible in that you wouldn't know who to contact.
Mm.
It wouldn't be easy to find out this information. But in principle, anyone could sort of make an appointment and go. But it's not an organized thing.
Mm.
I don't have a key for the cool room, so I would also then have to organize that with somebody else. Like, even for me, it takes a couple of steps.
Mm. And another question, outside of your scientific work, but more you as a person, you and your whole set of interests, what is your relationship to the visual? Because you work generally with numbers and, I guess, with lots and lots of data. What is your affinity with visual art or the visual in general?
Yeah, good question. I think... I'm imagining like all these figures that I make, and it's just like what I then consider to be visually like pleasing is within such a limited range, or what I imagine, you know, what kind of figure I might imagine that I put in an article is so limited, so limited. Like the amount of options that I will consider, it's so narrow, that scope. And yeah, I guess I think that's really, I guess, a bit sad, and like I would love it to be more expansive and to explore that more. One thing I have learned working a bit more with Jacqueline and over this time is that I sort of don't have time for everything, and that in a way there is a lot more I would love to explore or contribute in a more, like, in a broader sense, where in a more creative sense, but then I don't have time for everything, and at this point anyways I've decided to sort of focus on the science and the research and support, then have maybe a supporting role, or somehow we support each other.
Does art bring you something?
Outside of our relationship.
No, but also, apart from, I know that forever talking with you, if you tell about anything happening underneath the North Sea, I'm just overwhelmed. Yeah. But does it go the other way around? If you see artworks, maybe not mine because they're maybe too close, but also like what Eline is doing, or that would
definitely. I think I'm really intrigued, and I love to see. I think it's really interesting to see how different people take up these things that I look at through one lens. And then other people take it up with any other lens. And I think it's really interesting to see all the different relationships we can have with different parts of soil or other different parts of nature. And that, yeah, there's a lot of different relationships or ways of engaging out there. And I think interesting to, like, to consider all these different ways and to hear the insights and the thoughts and the feelings. And
that connects really well to actually also my, or it's interesting kind of, because my position in working with scientists is very much that I'm so intrigued by the in-depth study that you do and to hear all about it, but it's also what Jacqueline already said, extremely overwhelming, and you know, the lexicon you use, it's very rich and these are, I don't know, I try to act like a sponge and to kind of incorporate as much information as I can, not even knowing if I can or will use it in the process of making the artwork in the end. But in the end, what I love about my position as an artist is that I have the freedom to also not incorporate it and to instead work with maybe a story or a myth surrounding the thematic that we're dealing with, but then addressing this, you know, whether it's fact or fiction or something in between, but exactly addressing this discrepancy.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the reason that I maybe began with science was to sort of look at, because I was so intrigued by our sort of relationship with nature, but then went in this science direction, which is then really sort of pushing you towards understanding, like, deeper and deeper and like the smaller and smaller scale of something, and in more and more subtle detail. But then I guess maybe it's like the grass is always greener on the other side. Then I'm always intrigued as to how everything relates to everything else. And then I guess then maybe this is what I really appreciate and I take from either talking to you guys or engaging with, like, an artwork as its own entity, is like, yeah, this relationship or experience, and that we have other relations with different species or objects or even just concepts. And yeah, so it's a little bit like we're maybe both seeing, like, the grass is greener on the other side in some ways. Like, I'm going to delve in here now and then.
Yeah, but I also love my freedom that I can, you know, completely dedicate to this research field for an extended period of time, and then at some point I fall in love with a different subject or a different theme or a different landscape that I want to address, and then it's also, you know, I have the freedom to just kind of step out of the one and just completely engage with something else.
And
I guess a lot of freedom can also be challenging, but for me it's very enriching.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, but what you're doing is much, you know,
it is nowhere near as free.
No, but it's much deeper, and you are doing it's much more analysis on a micro level.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm just kind of touching the surface of what you are dealing with, but then, you know, in such a different way, in a visual or through words or through language or whatever, through sound.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if I agree. I think it's art has another way to express, but the deepness, if you could call it, like the deepness of knowledge, could also be a very...
Yeah, but you cannot compare a 5-year PhD trajectory to
30 years of practice.
No, but I guess, like, I wonder, because I think, so I think science is underpinned by, like, two things, which is evidence-based and peer review.
Yeah.
And I think in art, you definitely have peer review. But evidence-based, you could maybe have evidence-based, but it's not necessarily based on the physical. Evidence-based could also be based on, like, emotion or experience. And this could be a reason to continue a work.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
to repeat a work, or to modify it and do it again. Whereas, like, this evidence based in science has a narrower, stricter term of, yeah, you had an aim and a hypothesis, and did you meet that, and how are you going to mold your next project or research question? So maybe there is an evidence based in art, but it's, like, really broad.
Yeah.
Like, whereas in science it sort of says, okay, the evidence cannot be an immersion. like that's going to be part of it. You're going to have an emotional response. You're going to be disappointed or happy with the results, and this is going to motivate you or demotivate you and yada yada yada. But you can't make your entire decision on that. But in art, I guess you can also not make your entire decision on that. Can't write that in a grant. But maybe somehow it's valued more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do make decisions based on feeling in my tummy sometimes.
Yeah.
Rather than by knowledge from my head. Yeah.
Yeah. But also the, you know, the feeling, the knowledge in your head is not without the emotion. Like you can't have, and you can't think a thought. You can't have a piece of knowledge without having an emotional response, even to this very dry fact. Mm-hmm. You will have some kind of an emotional response.
But
always.
isn't in fact the base, the fundamentals of science and arts, curiosity? Just.
Yeah.
Really being curious, on, and the pathway may be different, but that's the biggest trigger.
They have a lot of overlap, art and science, when you think
I think
in this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I always also love it when, whether it's an artist or a scientist, when people talk with passion about that topic. And it could be like when you explained earlier about the course, you feel an emotion coming up, because that's probably also driving, I mean it's driving force for a lot of her. Most people probably. What's the passion of the soil?
The passion of the soil, like my passion for soil, or
no, the passion of soil itself.
The passion of soil itself.
When can we have an intimate relationship?
Yeah, I don't know. I think soil has its place, like anything has its place in the universe, and it comes together and it falls apart, and it's a home, but it's also a dumping ground. Like every place, and as to like its emotional core, I can't say at this point. Is there something you want to say?
Did you bring soil from Australia?
Yeah,
over to the Netherlands.
I did. I brought some samples. Because I needed to do the measurements over here, so they're samples from an alpine peatland at about 1,000 meters high, meters above sea level, which is generally not considered that alpine, but I think it's okay to call it alpine in the Netherlands. But it is considered alpine in a technical sense. Yeah, so I brought that over, and they're from a national park, and even just to take. The biggest thing was to take them out of the national park. This required a lot of permits, and it was like analyzed with scrutiny as to whether we should be able to take those samples. And rightly so, it was a very sensitive ecosystem. Once I saw it and was working there for a week, you could see that we had made a mark. We were four scientists trying to be as conscientious as possible, and you could see it didn't look as, the peatland wasn't as like spongy, as fluffy, as like buoyant as, you know, a week earlier when we had arrived.
But having these harsh restrictions, I know that there are strict restrictions on shells, you know, the beautiful shells. You're not allowed to transport them anymore and across borders, or I don't know. So soil has elevated to also being a precious item that you can't just bring out of out of an ecosystem. Or do I understand it wrongly?
It was, in that situation, it was definitely considered, precious. Mm. Like the whole ecosystem from, the tips of the leaves of the plants all the way down to the bedrock.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we have kind of the restrictions like that in the Netherlands.
Right, and so, and what would be the reason for that? Because we don't have the same, we, like, here, there's not the same, like, question of, like, we should preserve that nature, and because that is sort of untouched, even though you can question whether anything is untouched, because, yeah, the atmosphere is obviously at least impacted by humans. So is anything in the world untouched? But I guess in Australia there are large parts of land still that there's no roads or paths through there. No one goes there. No one's done
any harm.
Yeah. and then, but here everything has been, I think, touched on the surface. But that, does that make it less valuable?
Yeah.
And it's kind of sad to say that it is less valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was also asking, if you work with your homeland soil in your profession as a scientist, and you work with North Sea soil, do you feel a difference, or is it just numbers, or...
Well, I can say that people were, I think, when I would speak about my research, both of these projects, most people are far more interested in the submerged North Sea peats. Like, I guess the Australian peatland research community is very narrow. You know, there's all five of us.
Maybe they can, you can add a few artists.
Yeah, and but like, I don't know, they're also the way that the sea level rose. Like, I guess the peats that I was looking at beneath the North Sea are also, you know, this proxy, this marker of time between the Pleistocene and Holocene, and the North Sea Basin, the sea level rose in sort of a unique way there at very different rates in sort of a small space, and people are really curious as to why that happened. And the peat is like a marker of that. So there's kind of a community like interested in the submerged peats beneath North Sea. And whilst, and sort of like the peatlands in Australia are seen as very precious and very valuable, but in this way they're just sort of pushed to the side, like, don't touch them, protect them, but also no one's engaging with them. So there's not so many people maybe to talk about them with. And also maybe I'm stuck over here. And maybe there are people to talk about them with, but they're over there and I'm over here.
Yeah, because I think I remember that you did one of the peat ball sessions.
Yeah.
With your home soil.
But actually, I do really, I have, I guess I'm just like this sphagnum lover, and I feel really lucky whenever I get to see sphagnum or touch sphagnum, and sphagnum's the main peat forming vegetation, and then the samples I have from Australia are just sphagnum. They're just like, they're just plants. Yeah. There's just, they haven't even become soil yet. And they're just, you know, the peatland, the samples I have from Australia, it's meters of just sphagnum compacted together.
Yeah.
It hasn't even been decomposed into soil. Meters of that. And so, yeah, I love this. I feel so satisfied when I can look at this like compacted sphagnum and like see all the little leaves and little fibers and plants.
It's so visual how you describe this.
Beautiful.
I can see it in front of me. I imagine it.
I should have brought a sample.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next time.
Yeah.
Oh, we are here Sunday still.
Yeah.
Maybe they can come and collect a little piece. No, because it's. I'm also asking about it because Eline is also working on the phenomenon of pilgrims, people that travel long distances for whatever reason, but they often have in their, they often bring a little bit of soil or seeds from their home grounds. It's the same like, well, you can better tell about it, Eline. Like there's this, even though there are maybe thousands of miles in between you and your home soil, you can actually, people feel connected by bringing a little bit. A lot of Suriname people brought it to the Netherlands, and you know, every it seems like a lot of I think belonging is the best word. Belonging is connected with soil, which makes it also a very precious item.
Yeah, I also really think soil and earth has this a really special place in the world, because I feel that this is the source of biodiversity. This holds, this is the container of the microorganisms in the world, and from these microorganisms everything else has evolved. Everything else, you know, all of the different species, plants, humans, other animals. And it's sort of like we could chop down the rainforest, and if we still have the biodiversity of the soil, another rainforest over millions of years could still come back.
Yeah.
But if we got rid of the soil with all of these microorganisms, I don't even know if the rainforest would survive. Well, of course, like say there was a dead soil, just a soil with no microorganisms. Like, I think we would lose so much biodiversity in the rainforest itself, because the rainforest, all of the plants have a symbiotic relationships with the microorganisms in the soil.
Yeah.
And the nutrients wouldn't be able to go through their nutrient cycles to be available, made available to the plants. So, for me, this is like one of the really special components of soil.
Yeah. Soil is where all life begins and ends.
Yes.
Human life, as well as animal, plant, other sorts of life, all kinds of microorganisms, fungi, you name it. That's so special.
So, we were just listening to Drowning in the Sound by Amanda Palmer, and before that we had Breathing by Grupa. And now we have Jacqueline and Alina, and also myself, Tanya, on Soil Matters. And we're going to recap about our last couple of weeks. How was it?
Intense. Should I elaborate?
Yeah, maybe about this 2 weeks, the first week.
The first week, it was just you.
Yeah, but we kicked off with sensoilations.
With the sensoilation at Repeat Fest, we had four evenly spaced throughout a 24-hour period sessions at Repeat. So we had a lot of time to relax in between, and we started at 4:30 in the morning and ended at 9 p.m. Four sessions. It was really, really wonderful. I had a great time.
Yeah.
And Alina also joined us for a session, and also Deborah Solomon, which was really lovely.
Yeah.
And actually, I wanted to suggest making a soil ball now during our radio, but I sort of forgot, because then we ended up being a little bit rushed for time. So I think that's just a really wonderful process to do whilst, you know, you're talking or reflecting or sharing information, to be like working with the soil and create. It doesn't even have to be a ball. I think I would love to also explore other shapes.
Yes, of course.
Make a whole storyboard out of soil.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was the Repeat Fest. That was a big one, and it was really, really great, and already looking forward to next year.
Yeah.
And then?
But it was also the kickoff of... using the Glazen Huis of Zoon te Source in Amsterdam Park as a workspace. Because, the project I've been working on has been going on for 3 years. It was already in the fifth phase, because everything, always when I took one step to develop a new artwork, it also evolved in the next questions for another artwork. So at a certain point I made something together in reference with a work by Elina that was supposed to be exhibited 1.5 years ago, and due to COVID it was one of the first things that went sliding down the calendar. But at a certain point, and it's now due to be exhibited in January 2022, so by that time it has been delayed for like 2 years. But the work was already there, only nobody had seen it. It's in my studio. It's like Elina says, it's gathering dust, which is actually a very, very good, good process, also in the arts.
But I feel like it's like a bit like my soil archive library that's just sitting in the big fridge.
Yeah. And so I was looking forward to. I'm going to do another residency this year, so I will be 3 months away. And I had an urge to do something before that, so I brought everything connected with this project. I brought to the Glazen Huis, invited Tanja and Eline, come and join me. Let's do stuff instead of only working in our heads, maybe, or dealing with shifting calendars. Let's just engage and try to figure out how we can develop a concept for next year project or whatever. So the first week I had the space for myself, starting to rearrange and reorder. I also brought some samples of photographs of work I did like 20 years ago.
Here?
Yeah.
Oh, you have to show me.
And also because I had the idea I would like to touch on an other kind of relationship with soil.
What other kind?
Yes. So I was thinking, well, maybe it's nice to invite a dancer. And Eline came up with the suggestion, maybe it's nice to invite somebody who's really working with language in another way that we work or use it. So that was more or less shaped the fundamentals of the second week, because then Eline also came.
Mm. Yeah, so for me, it was wonderful that you took this initiative to indeed bring all our material from the past few years into the Glazen Huis, to set it up and to actually look at all the different trajectories that have been going on, what we produced, and also to ask ourselves, where are we standing right now? What is still urgent after working on it for a couple of years? And what do we want to continue on? And
do we want to continue together, of the three of us, or in what kind of...
Yeah, exactly.
...shape we can connect?
One thing I would like to share that is still very much in progress, but is that Jacqueline has been working in this ceramics residency last year, where she worked with fossils, with all kinds of soils and bones and dust and I don't know the English word.
Porcelain.
And been making molds, and to use this mold to form the shape, you know, to use all those materials into... form it into a specific shape, and it's a very intense but very special working process, because in the oven, baking all of these materials in the oven, a lot happens. So it's been lovely.
Actually, I started connecting with ceramics because of the parallel between ceramic techniques and climate. Because it has to do with moist, it has to do with temperature, it has to... So that's why I actually connected.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
With ceramics, because I'm not a ceramist.
Mm. No, yeah.
But, so this has been coming forward for me, and we had the chance this week to pick up, to visit my soil cases
from
my Roman lava soil. Finally, it has been archived here in Amsterdam at the exhibition space for... Well, over 2 years now, I think. And I did not have access to it, thanks to Corona. And now finally we had the chance to go and take some samples and, you know, have this orangey terracotta soil in our hands. And in conversation with Jacqueline, we were thinking about making a mold of the tree boring, the tree drilling, and to use this lava material, this soil, sub-lava soil, in the form of a tree boring, and a tree drilling. And then after it has been baked, after it went through this whole ceramic process, to activate it by asking performers or musicians to interact with it. Because this week we have already invited a performer who has been a dancer who has been engaging with the soil, and it's so wonderful to see how they position themselves towards the soil, towards the space, towards the sunlight, the shade that the person is casting. There's all these different elements that this performer, this dancer, took into consideration when moving the body. Mm. As a, you know, towards the soil and to interact with the soil. So I guess from this experience we started to have a dialogue. So now this will be our following steps, and we'll see how that goes.
I'm really excited. I think it's really beautiful to try and like hear then this interaction between the tree and the soil. And sort of the space in between that. I'm also a bit intrigued as to, like, did you analyze, like, the tree rings at all, or, like, speculate over sort of the climate that you can see?
From the past 87 years?
Yeah, from the past 87 years.
Yeah.
And was this influenced by watering or mowing, and is it also talking, and is it also a story of like this human created climate?
Well, I did briefly analyze it, very briefly, with the dendrologist. She could not help me further because she had the influenza flu at the time. I would love to dig deeper into that. Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. No, because there's a whole world to discover, yeah.
Yeah, about their watering system.
Exactly. Well, when you...
Also the climate that just happens to be there, the microclimate, the bigger climate.
I'm sure there's lots to discover, because already now, with my limited knowledge, and you can, when you observe the tree rings, you can already see, indeed, that there have been drier years and more moist years, and how that has influenced the growth of the tree. And
yeah, and I wonder if that information could somehow, totally up to the musician of course, but be also something to inspire what they want to create.
And then there's also
there's one story that could be told. Doesn't need to be the story.
One of the many stories. Yeah. And then there's also the image, in my mind at least, of the tree in Rome with a hole in it.
Do you have a photograph?
An incomplete tree.
A holy tree.
I have it, not right now, but I have it, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to see. The home tree.
So, because you said the tree core is like 40 centimeters, so the tree is like diameter 80.
Yeah, ish. Yeah.
Ish. Okay.
So it grew quite fast for being such a young tree.
Also nice size.
Yeah. Huh? Mm. I love a tree hug.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, other question. So I think I understand part of your motivation for working with ceramics was to create an artifact, to maybe a gift or some other token or gesture to perhaps put into a reverse drilling to give back to the soil. Could you imagine using this ceramic bow or wand?
Wand?
To put back into
The
tree. Have you thought about that?
Well, I have actually. And also thinking about, the drilling in the ground, that's also a hole, if I could bring something back into it. But then I'm a little bit unsure about the aspect of alienation, because if I would put a porcelain wand or a porcelain bow, let's call it like this, into a pine tree, what do I do to this tree? I would, I personally choose not to, have a spiral in my body. What's that in English? The anticonception.
The contraception.
Contraception. Sorry. Yeah. What's it called in English? The coil.
Yeah.
I choose not to have a coil inside me because I don't want to have an alien object made from completely, material that the human body is kind of resisting in a way, and.
It's not actually found in the human body at all.
If I don't want to do that to myself, then who am I to do that to a tree? So I do like the idea a lot, but it's just very delicate, and I have not found a good answer to it. So if you have opinions on this, I would be happy to hear them. How do you deal with you cannot make decisions for the tree, what he or she or it, them, they like. But, I don't know,
Well, the other location we could invite Laurie is perhaps to this tree.
Or travel to Italy.
Travel to Italy to this tree.
After New York, yeah?
Yeah, and do the performance there. We can do a tour.
Yeah.
With
and
Laurie.
And we ask Laurie to perform with the porcelain bow made from...
To serenade the tree.
To thank it.
Yeah. Yeah. Next to that...
Still tricky. But never mind. We need to... Yeah.
But I am... So research says that trees can do communicate orally. Mm. But at a frequency that we do not... hear or cannot speak, and I wonder at all if it would be possible to try to communicate with the tree, to try to like use this frequency, frequency.
I don't know. We probably really have to get to go loose from our human systems and try to find something in a completely different system, which is extremely difficult, but. Haven't there been studies where they use echolocation in an attempt to communicate? I'm not sure if this... I think Mancuso did research in this field. The Italian researcher that Berthe worked with?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Studying.
Well, we've got 5 minutes left. Is there anything else you wanted to say, mention, or reflect upon before we wrap up?
No, I'm good.
Right. Same. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Danya, for inviting us.
Yeah, and thank you for your questions. You're very thought-provoking.
Right back at you.
Die the light. die, 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 die,